Before we get on with today's episode of Morbidology, I'd like to mention today's sponsor, Crime Juicy Cocktail Hour. This is an amazing weekly true crime podcast, hosted by Carrie Ann, Becca, and Krista, three best friends that truly bounce off each other. With topics such as cannibalism, the insanity defense, and human trafficking, this true crime podcast covers all angles. I've binged all 10 episodes the past week and really enjoyed their interview with Ellis Armistead, who has worked on numerous infamous cases, including the Columbine Massacre and the Oklahoma bombing. So if you're looking for a new true crime podcast that's extensively researched, manages to feel like you're hanging out with a group of friends, then please check out Crime Juicy Cocktail Hour. They're available on all podcast platforms, including Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and everywhere in between. Also, click the link in my show notes and give them a like on Facebook. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. Dalton Township is a civil township of Muskegon County. It's the home of around 8,000 residents and is around 40 miles northwest of the hustle and bustle of Grand Rapids. It was a pleasant summer evening in 2014 when police were alerted to what was initially believed to be a tragic hit and run. However, upon closer inspection, it soon became apparent that this certainly was no hit and run. It was around 5 p.m. on the evening of the 29th of June 2014, and 36-year-old Rebecca Bletch put in her headphones and went for a jog in her hometown of Dalton Township, Michigan. Rebecca was a wife, mother, and a physical therapist. She and her husband, Kevin, had an 11-year-old daughter named Ellie, and they were happily married. They had been together for almost 20 years and had been married for almost 5 years. Kevin worked as a boilermaker, and at the time, he and their daughter were out of the county visiting Kevin's uncle's cabin. The family were preparing for a big camping trip, and Kevin and their daughter went up to the cabin early to get it ready for the July 4th holiday weekend. Rebecca worked as a physical therapist at Sanctuary at the Shore in Grand Haven. As the administrator said, she was loved by everybody. Rebecca loved her job and came to work each morning with a massive smile on her face. She would bring along her therapy dog, Oreo. In her free time, Rebecca coached basketball at Wreaths Puffer Middle School and was a keen jogger. Rebecca was very active and would often go out walking with Ellie or biking. Both Kevin and Rebecca were well known throughout the close-knit community and were known to be helpful neighbours. They never had any issues with anybody. Rebecca's uncle, Tim Donkin, described her as vibrant and the kind of person who could bring a smile to anybody's face. He said, "She was always willing to pitch in and help, always seemed to be concerned about others." On that evening, Rebecca set out on her regular jogging route. While this route was regular, she didn't jog it every single day. But it wouldn't be uncommon to see Rebecca out on this specific route. Around an hour after Rebecca set out for her daily jog, a 911 call came in from a man who discovered Rebecca's lifeless body at the side of Automobile Road, a country road around 1 mile away from Rebecca's home. The man had been driving along the road with his wife when they spotted Rebecca. His wife was a registered nurse and she began performing CPR on Rebecca, while her husband called police.
911, where is your emergency?
The corner of Riley Thompson and Automobile. It's on Automobile Road. We come up to this lady, she's laying in the road. I think she was hit by a car.
Okay.
She's got a head injury.
Okay, so I'm Riley Thompson and Automobile?
Yes, yeah, on Automobile Road.
Okay, which way from?
4300 Automobile Road.
4300 Automobile, okay. Stay on the phone here with me, okay? I'm going to get some help right out there for you. Did you see what happened to her?
She has a pulse. We just came up on her.
Is she unconscious?
Yes, she is.
Okay, you stay on the phone with me. Is she breathing?
She is breathing. She has a pulse.
Okay, did you see who hit her? Does she have obvious injuries?
She has a head injury.
Okay.
She's got a head injury and she's laying face down.
Okay, don't move her around, okay?
Yep, we're not moving her around.
Okay. Is she by herself?
You need to hurry. She's all by herself.
Okay.
It's really irregular. My wife is a nurse, so she's...
Okay, sir, I got help that's going to start help, okay?
Okay. What else? I don't know what else to do.
Okay, sir. Just tell me if she's...
Okay. She's having her pulse and it's really weak.
Okay. Weak pulse?
She has not been moved, but she's halfway in the road.
Okay. Get your car.
The road is not busy.
Okay. What kind of car are you in?
I am in a Toyota Camry, burgundy.
Okay.
I'm right in the middle of the road. Nobody's going to get by me.
Okay. Get your flashers on.
Yes.
Okay. Ask your wife if she thinks she needs CPR.
Does she need CPR, Michelle? Does she need CPR? She's still breathing.
Okay.
And she has a pulse.
Okay. Tell your wife that if she needs CPR, I can help her with that, and I will stay on the phone with you. The fire department and the ambulance are on the way.
An ambulance was immediately dispatched to the scene, but tragically, it was already too late for Rebecca. She was declared dead at the scene. It was initially believed that Rebecca had been the victim of a hit and run. However, it was soon enough discovered that Rebecca had been shot 4 times in the head. The case quickly turned into a murder investigation, and a task force was assembled to investigate. Robbery was quickly ruled out as a motivation. When Rebecca's body was found, she still had her cell phone, tucked into her armband, as well as her jewellery. There's also much speculation that Rebecca's murder had been some kind of hit, potentially even a case of misidentification. Investigators announced that they were in the process of looking into the background of Rebecca and her family to see if they had any kind of enemies. They were also analysing Rebecca's phone to see if she had been in contact with anybody, leading up to her murder. With the investigation in full swing, a reward for $2,500 was put forward by Silent Observer for information that could lead to an arrest. This reward fund would quickly be increased to $10,000. Just days after the murder, investigators would announce that they were in a stump and that they were no closer to finding a suspect or a motivation than they were on day one. Muskegon County Sheriff Dean Rosler said, "We're in the dark right now. Now we're just looking into the victim's background and those of her associates." They enlisted the help of Michigan State Police as well as police departments from the cities of Muskegon and Whitehall and Fruitport Township. Dalton Township was sparsely populated, and crimes of this nature very rarely happened there. They needed all of the help that they could get. The murder really terrified the residents of Dalton Township, not only those who knew Rebecca. Her cousin, Erin Wilkes, said that the murder had made women terrified to go outside alone. In a bid to calm their fears, Rebecca's family organized a woman's self-defense clinic at Reith's Puffer High School. It would be conducted by North Winds Martial Arts. Investigators would quickly announce that Kevin was not a suspect in his wife's murder and that he had an airtight alibi. They also announced that based on phone records, they were able to establish that Rebecca had been alive close to 6 p.m., indicating that she had been murdered very shortly before she was found. Eventually, the tips began to dwindle as the weeks slowly turned to months. In January, Rebecca's family spoke publicly about the murder for the first time. Her sister, Jessica Josephson, said that not a day goes by where she doesn't think about her sister. Rebecca was the oldest sister of 3 and the second oldest after her brother, Philip Wimberg. Jessica said that Rebecca was motherly and she always looked after her siblings. Kevin said that he wanted to speak publicly about the loss of his wife in the hopes that it would lead to some tips in the case. He admitted that he knew that some people probably speculated that he was involved, because statistically, that's usually the case. He said that he missed his wife desperately, stating, "I miss her more and more every day." Kevin said that Rebecca was extremely outgoing, and joked that she spoke enough for the both of them. He spoke about Ellie and said that she had been the strong one in the family, pushing everybody forward through the stages of grief. Rebecca's sisters and her husband shared their frustration with the investigation and how it had come to a standstill. They shared their fear that investigators were grasping at straws, but said that they had put their faith into the investigators and still hoped that one day justice would be served. They believed that the murder was a completely random, opportunistic crime, and that there was nobody in Rebecca's life that would have wanted her dead. For example, they wondered maybe if it was somehow gang or drug related, and wondered if Rebecca had seen something that she shouldn't have. They urged members of the public to come forward if they knew anything about Rebecca's murder, no matter how insignificant it may have seemed. Her sisters would speak with M Live about the type of person that their sister was.
She was the oldest girl. She was motherly to the two of us. She taught me how to do my hair. She taught me how to do my makeup. She was everything I wanted to be. I lost my role model. My hero.
Eventually, a year would pass with no updates in the case. Her family would arrange a 5K run in memory of Rebecca on the one-year anniversary to the murder. All of the registration fees would be going into a college fund for Rebecca's daughter, Ellie. The event was a reflection of Rebecca, who was a keen runner and a social butterfly. The family announced that they had wanted to hold the 5K run so people in the community could get to know Rebecca's family. Around the same time, a number of billboards were erected on roadways throughout Muskegon County, with information regarding the murder as well as a phone number to call with any tips. Meanwhile, investigators announced that they would be reviewing all of the evidence in the case with a fine tooth comb to make sure that they hadn't missed anything. There was absolutely no traction in the case until almost a year later, when it was announced that investigators were looking into whether 46-year-old Jeffrey Willis was involved in Rebecca's murder. Jeffrey had been charged with attempting to kidnap a 16-year-old girl in Muskegon County's Fruitland Township. The girl had been at a party on the 16th of April, when the person who was supposed to drive her home got drunk. She decided to walk home alone, but on the way, she somehow got lost. She said that she had been lost for several hours when Jeffrey pulled up alongside her in his silver van and asked her if she needed a lift. The girl said no, but asked if she could use Jeffrey's phone. However, she noticed that there were cars behind the van and she was conscious about causing a backup, so she jumped into his van. She said that Jeffrey immediately rolled up the window and locked the doors. She asked to use the phone, but he said that his phone was now all of a sudden dead. Jeffrey began to drive with the teenage girl in the van and then pulled out a black handgun. She stated, "I really thought he was going to kill me, and I thought he was going to take me. I was just scared." She said that as he drove, she managed to unlock the door and hurled herself out of the moving vehicle. She ran to a nearby house and the occupant let her in and called 911. Jeffrey was identified as a suspect in this case after the girl gave a description of the silver van, as well as a description of her kidnapper. Investigators drove around the area looking for surveillance cameras which could have picked up an image of the kidnapper. They found a camera at a blueberry farm which picked up the silver van, and an expert was able to ascertain the make, model and year of the van, narrowing the search down. When Jeffrey was arrested in relation to this crime, the teenage girl identified him as the man who had abducted her. Following his arrest, investigators on Rebecca's case started looking into whether he was a potential suspect in her murder, as well as the April 2013 disappearance of Jessica Haringa, who vanished from a gas station in Norton Shores where she worked. In that case, a witness had seen a suspicious silver van at the gas station around the same time that Jessica disappeared. The witness said that the driver was outside, seemingly rearranging something in the rear hatch. The silver van was later spotted on surveillance cameras travelling north on Grand Haven Road. Just after 11 p.m. that night, a customer called police to report that the gas station was empty. Responding officers found Jessica's purse, but she was nowhere to be seen. Investigators would obtain a search warrant for Jeffrey's home, as well as for his silver van. In his van, they discovered a secret compartment which contained syringes filled with an unknown liquid, which appeared to be some kind of sedative, as well as handcuffs, rope, chains, a mask, rubber gloves, a bar with wrist restraints, a ball gag, and photographs of women chained and bound. They also found a .22 caliber semi-automatic pistol with the serial number destroyed. The search of his home would uncover child pornography, as well as videos of bound women. During his arraignment on charges of kidnapping, assault with a deadly weapon, and 2 felony firearm counts, prosecutor DJ Hilson said that the van was designed not only to kidnap women, but to take sexual advantage of women. He argued for $1 million bond because of the extreme danger that he said Jeffrey posed to the safety of the community. He further said that they would now be extensively investigating the connection between Jeffrey and Jessica and Rebecca. At the time of his arrest, Jeffrey was working at Herman Miller Incorporated in Spring Lake Township. He had earlier worked as a janitor for North Muskegon Public Schools between 1995 and 1998. Then in 1999, he had been fired from his job as a custodian at Fruitport Community Schools after he was caught viewing porn on a grade school computer. According to neighbours, he was quite peculiar and had displayed disturbing behaviour. Following his arrest, one neighbour said that her 19-year-old twin daughters were afraid of him and felt that he often stared at them strangely. The neighbour also said that on one occasion, she saw Jeffrey taking photos of the interior of her home through her window. On the 24th of May, Jeffrey was charged with the murder of Rebecca after it was determined that the gun found inside his van had been the gun used during the shooting. During a press conference, prosecutor Hilson said, "Today is a sad day for many people, but it is a happy day for law enforcement." He said that investigators didn't believe that Rebecca and Jeffrey knew each other and that the murder was completely random. The charges came as a welcome relief to Rebecca's family, who had been waiting a long 2 years for traction in the case. Her mother, Deborah Reamer, said that she was thankful for the bravery of the teenage abduction victim, stating, "Thank God this girl had the guts to jump." Her family shared their belief that Rebecca was shot dead after she fought Jeffrey, as opposed to getting into his van. Her sister Jessica said that it was hard to think of Rebecca's last moments on Earth, fighting for her life. Jeffrey would additionally be charged with creating and downloading child pornography. The charges alleged that he did arrange for, produce, make copies, reproduce or finance sexually abusive images of children. He faced 4 counts of using a computer to do these crimes. It was alleged that in June of 2015, Jeffrey had used a hidden camera in his bathroom to capture explicit videos of a girl under the age of 18. 2 such videos were found in his home. In the other case, investigators had found multiple images of child pornography on Jeffrey's hard drive. Do you grind your teeth in your sleep? If so, you're one of the 40 million Americans who do. There are a number of causes such as stress, anxiety, or even an abnormal bite. Grinding your teeth can sadly cause a number of problems such as worn enamel, tooth decay, sleeplessness, and expensive dental problems. According to dentists, the number one teeth grinding prevention is a custom fitted night guard. However, these can be very costly, with the average dentist charging around $200 to $300 per night guard, and you can grind through several of those a year. That's where today's sponsor, Smile Brilliant, comes in. Smile Brilliant uses a lab direct process to bring you the same custom fitted night guard, but for as little as $45 per night guard. In addition, they also have custom fitted whitening trays and the Carry Pro electronic toothbrush. For me personally, taking care of my teeth is of utmost importance, and Smile Brilliant make it straightforward and affordable. Just head on over to smilebrilliant.com and use the promo code MORBIDOLOGY at checkout for 30% off. Once again, that's smilebrilliant.com and use code MORBIDOLOGY for 30% off your order. In June, it was announced that on his attorney's advice, Jeffrey opted against holding a probable cause hearing on the kidnapping charge against him. This meant that the kidnapping case would move directly to trial. During the hearing, it was revealed that the prosecution believed that Jeffrey had abducted the teenage girl with the intent of sexually abusing her. Meanwhile, Jeffrey's cousin, Kevin Blum, who's employed by the Michigan Department of Corrections at a state prison in Muskegon, was charged with lying to police during the course of the investigation. Kevin had given false statements in regards to when he had last seen Jeffrey and whether he had ever seen him with a handgun. It would also be revealed that Kevin had initially told investigators that Jeffrey had told him he had no involvement in Jessica's disappearance. However, during a second police interview, Kevin said that Jeffrey had admitted to him that he was involved. In fact, Kevin had told Detective Lieutenant Michael Kasher that he had been forced to help Jeffrey take care of Jessica. But he later recanted this statement and said that he had made it all up. Kevin would also be ordered to stand trial. Shortly after his cousin's arrest, a pretrial hearing was held to determine whether there was enough evidence for Jeffrey to stand trial for Rebecca's murder. In court, Prosecutor Hilson referred to Rebecca's murder as probably the most disturbing case he had ever handled. He said, "This man is a very disturbing individual, and I'm very glad we got him off the streets. I don't know how many lives were saved." During the hearing, more information regarding the murder case and Jeffrey's potential involvement was detailed. It was revealed that computer analysis found that Jeffrey had downloaded many videos depicting necrophilia, as well as kidnap and kill scenarios, some of which were acted, and apparently some of which appeared to be real. It was also revealed that he had a folder on his hard drive titled VICS, which was believed to be short for victims. There was also a subfolder in this folder titled RBS, which were Rebecca's initials and what appeared to be a coded reference to the date of her murder. The folder also contained photographs of Rebecca that Jeffrey had saved from the internet, as well as reward posters. A co-worker of Jeffrey, named Michelle Schnow-Talla, testified during the hearing that she had spoke several times with Jeffrey about a .22 caliber Walther handgun, which she had purchased back in 2012. She testified that she had last seen her gun on the weekend of the 22nd and 23rd of February, 2013, and she believed that Jeffrey had entered her home without knowledge or permission on several occasions and had stolen her gun.
Did the defendant, Mr. Willis, ever visit you while you were at home?
While I was at my home? No, he did not.
Right. Were you ever made aware of any times that he came by your house when you were not at home?
Yes.
How many times?
At least two or three.
And how, I guess, what spurred that conversation or what kind of drew your attention to the fact that maybe he came to your house when you weren't there?
Because Mr. Willis knew where I lived. He frequently snowmobiled. And because I live near where he snowmobiled, I would come home from work in the morning and see snowmobile tracks around my house. And I would confront him about it the next time we seen each other at work. And he'd admit, "Oh yes, I drove by your house."
And that happened?
Drove through your yard.
Okay. And that happened at least on two occasions that you can recall?
At least, yes. And, every winter.
All right. And those two occasions happened after you purchased this firearm?
Yes.
Michelle said that she had noticed snowmobile tracks in her yard and confronted Jeffrey. She said that he admitted that they had come from him. Under cross-examination, Michelle said that she had never reported the gun as stolen, but also said that on a number of occasions, Jeffrey had asked her to give him her underwear, to which she refused. There was testimony regarding the gun retrieved from Jeffrey's van, which showed that the gun was the same gun used in the murder of Rebecca. Detective Sergeant Tom Flowers testified about the sinister items found inside Jeffrey's van. Judge Richard Clute found that there was enough evidence and ordered Jeffrey to stand trial for Rebecca's murder. Just the following day, he would be additionally hit with three felony charges in relation to the secret footage he had taken of underage girls in his bathroom. Meanwhile, Jeffrey's wife of almost 13 years, Charlene Willis, filed for divorce, citing a breakdown of the marriage. According to the prosecution's office and Charlene's attorney, she had no knowledge of her husband's double life and had been assisting with the investigation. Just a couple of days later, search warrants were released and revealed that in addition to the sinister items found inside Jeffrey's van, investigators had also found a 5-page list of serial killers of the US, along with 3 pages of women's names and phone numbers tucked together inside a bag. This bag was found in a shed attic roof. Furthermore, when Jeffrey was arrested for abducting the teenager, just a couple of days beforehand, he had been under surveillance by a sheriff's detective after he was seen slowly driving through a parking lot, almost as if he were searching for a potential victim. Back in 2007, he had also been reported by a woman for videotaping her and following her from a Sam's Club parking lot. Towards the end of August, Jeffrey's cousin, Kevin, appeared in court and pleaded guilty to lying to police regarding the disappearance of Jessica Haringa. It would be revealed that Kevin had initially denied any knowledge of Jessica's disappearance, before stating that Kevin told investigators that shortly after the 26th of April, 2013, Jeffrey had asked Kevin to stop by a house on Bailey Street, in the city of Norton Shores. This home was owned by Jeffrey's late grandfather and had since been left abandoned. Kevin told investigators that once inside the home, he entered the basement and observed a female lying motionless on the floor, with her hands and legs restrained. He said that there was a video camera set up on the table next to the body. Kevin stated that he believed that this woman was Jessica. However, at the end of the interview, Kevin then contradicted himself and said that he had made the entire story up. Another search warrant would be released. Which revealed that in addition to the subfolder titled RSB in the folder titled VICS, there was another subfolder titled JLH, which were the initials of Jessica. Inside that folder were numerous electronic images of news reports and photographs regarding the disappearance of Jessica. Investigators had searched Jeffrey's grandfather's home on Bailey Street a number of times, but they never found any evidence that Jessica was ever there. Unsurprisingly, Jeffrey would additionally be charged with the kidnap and murder of Jessica. These charges had been a long time coming, but they were still heartbreaking for those who were still holding out hope that Jessica would be found alive. According to the prosecution, they believed that Jessica had died at the hands of Jeffrey within days of her disappearance. Prosecutor Hilson announced that Jessica was abducted with the intent to engage in criminal sexual penetration or criminal sexual contact. He further announced that they planned on charging Kevin as an accessory after Jessica's death. Just the following day, Jeffrey pleaded not guilty to the murder, while Kevin also pleaded not guilty to the accessory charge. After the charges were filed, a transcript of a Norton Shores Police Department detective sworn criminal complaint and warrant were made public. It revealed that just the week after Jessica had vanished, Jeffrey was brought in for questioning, quite simply because he lived in the area and had owned a silver van. He denied being at the gas station and said that he had been at home from 9:30 to 12:30 with his wife. He said he then left to go to his grandfather's house and then looked for wood for his dog kennel. He said he then went to Taco Bell. However, Jeffrey's claims were not in line with his cell phone records, which put him at his grandfather's house at 11:23 p.m., 11:59 p.m., and 12:05 a.m. Furthermore, Detective Casher shared his belief that Jeffrey had stalked Jessica. His credit card and some statements from witnesses led them to determine that Jeffrey had visited the store where Jessica worked around 15 to 16 times in the lead-up to her disappearance. And one record showed that he made a purchase at the store the night before when Jessica was working. Detective Kasher also revealed that Kevin had actually been a lot more detailed in his confession in regards to seeing Jessica in the basement. He in fact had told investigators that he had helped Jeffrey wrap Jessica's body up in a sheet in the basement and later helped him bury her body near railroad tracks near the intersection of Laketon and Sheridan. He had told investigators that the grave had already been dug and that there were shovels there. While he had claimed that they buried her, despite a search, investigators were never able to find Jessica's body. Jeffrey would be ordered to stand trial for the murder of Jessica, as well as for the murder of Rebecca. Before the end of 2016, Jeffrey's defense attorneys asked the court to dismiss the murder charge in relation to Rebecca's murder. They argued that Jeffrey's constitutional rights were violated by seizures of his papers by law enforcement while he was in jail, and argued that these papers were only meant to be seen by Jeffrey's defense attorneys. Defense Thomas Oatman wrote in the motion, "This instruction into the defendant's attorney-client communications revealed the entire defense strategy, as surely as if the government had eavesdropped on defendant's meeting with counsel. Regrettably, there is no way to conduct a fair trial in this case anymore." Ultimately, however, the judge would rule that the murder trial could go ahead when he determined that the evidence did not establish that the prosecution had been advised of any defense strategies contained in the papers. Jeffrey was ordered to stand trial for Rebecca's murder in June of 2017. Just 2 months before the trial was scheduled to begin, Prosecutor Hilson asked that instead of three separate trials, could Jeffrey stand one trial for all three cases? He said he was making the request because all three investigations had so much overlapping evidence. In short, all three cases were intertwined with one another. The judge would turn down the request, stating that one trial would require significant mental gymnastics for the jurors, as they considered all of the evidence. The murder trial would then be pushed back to September, and then would be pushed back once more to October. Shortly before the trial began, Jeffrey approved a short interview from behind bars. It was the first time that he had ever spoken publicly about the crimes he had been accused of. He said that he had lost 127 pounds since being in jail, and said that the emotional and physical stress had been taking a toll on him. He said he was nervous about his upcoming trial, and said, "I want people to know I could not do this. This is something I did not do. I'm not a monster. I did not do this." Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and their today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counseling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counseling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counseling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counselors specializing in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counselor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. On the 18th of October, the murder trial began. During opening statements, Prosecutor Hilson said that Rebecca was murdered by Jeffrey when his attempt to kidnap her went wrong. He said that Jeffrey wanted to get Rebecca into his van, where he had hidden a rape kit. He also mentioned the murder of Jessica and the kidnapping of the teenage girl, and said that the prosecution believed that all three crimes were committed due to Jeffrey's deviant desire to rape and kill. He warned the jury that there was going to be some grim testimony regarding Jeffrey's involvement with porn on the dark web, which included hundreds of rape and kill videos. Defense Frederick Johnson, during his opening statements, refuted this, and said he would be putting forward the theory that Rebecca had actually been killed by Jeffrey's cousin, Kevin.
My remarks won't take nearly as long here because we're taking a different approach in this particular matter than the prosecutor is. Quite frankly, we think at the end of the day, when you finally get this matter, that the evidence will show and that the instructions will indicate that you are here to decide only one thing, and that's what's happening with Rebecca Blatch. That is these other informations about these other parties, Ms. Herringa and MJN, they're just not before you. And that this Rebecca Blatch situation that you're going to be asked to decide, and that's what we'll be focusing on during the course of this trial. Quite frankly, we believe that once you hear that story as a part of some other grand scheme of things with a lot of different information in it that may or may not be interpreted as the prosecutor would like you to, that you will find that my client is not responsible for Mrs. Blatch's death.
He suggested that Kevin had been Facebook stalking Rebecca, who he knew because both of their children played soccer together. Defence Johnson stated, it was in fact Mr. Blum that did the shooting. He said that Kevin allegedly had details of the murder that weren't documented in the media. As he said, he had inside information. The first witness to testify for the prosecution was Michelle Clint, who had found Rebecca's body with her husband Mark. Michelle was a nurse, and she said that first of all, she thought that Rebecca had been hit by a vehicle. She knew that she had suffered a serious head injury. The 911 call that Mark placed after discovering Rebecca was played out. They knew that Rebecca was still breathing and had a slight pulse, but Michelle said that she was afraid of performing CPR, because that would involve moving Rebecca, which she didn't think was wise, because she thought she had been hit by a car. When paramedics arrived at the scene, they transferred Rebecca to an ambulance, where they discovered that she had actually been the victim of a shooting. Sheriff's deputies would testify about the crime scene. They'd found a pile of items that belonged to Rebecca on the opposite side of the road. These items included a neoprene armband containing a mobile phone, earbuds and sunglasses. They also testified that a .22 caliber shell casing was found in the middle of the road, while Deputy Scott Foster said he noticed that there was bruising to one of Rebecca's wrists, as well as bruising on her left ribcage area.
Now, obviously, did you do any cursory looking around the scene?
Initially, yes. I did. I did.
All right. I'm going to show you a couple photographs here, Deputy.
Okay.
What's marked as proposed People's Exhibit 1. I want you to take a look at that. Could you describe what that is, please?
It's a neoprene, like an arm case for an electronic device and some earbuds.
Now, how that photograph is depicting it, is that how you saw it on the roadway?
As I recall, yes, they were like in a stacked manner, kind of all together.
All right. And do you recall observing any shell casings, visible shell casings?
Eventually, yes, I did.
Okay.
Once Deputy Foster arrived.
All right. I'm going to show you what's marked as People's Exhibit Number 2. Can you describe what that photograph is, please?
That's a shell casing laying on the blacktop.
And was that the shell casing that was kind of in the roadway itself?
Yes, that was in the roadway.
All right. Correct. Now, the area where... Well, let me ask you this question first. Ultimately, was the body that you had seen on the roadway, was that person eventually identified?
Yes, she was.
And who was she identified as?
Rebecca Blatch.
The pathologist who had conducted the autopsy, Dr. Brandy Shattuck, would reveal more about the injuries that Rebecca had sustained. She said that Rebecca had been shot 4 times in the head, which had already been publicly released. However, she revealed that the bullets had been fired from behind Rebecca and off to her side. 3 of those wounds were entrance wounds, and the 4th was a grazing wound. She said that any of these shots would have knocked Rebecca down immediately. Her testimony would be followed by testimony from Sheriff's Detective Brian Harris, who said that based on the shell casings and the position of the wounds, the shooter moved, fired in the center of the road, then moved towards the edge of the road and fired again. He said it looked as though the shooter shot once and then moved closer towards Rebecca to continue shooting. He said that the bruising to Rebecca had likely been caused when she fell after being shot. Following this testimony, Prosecutor Hilson switched gears and introduced testimony regarding the disappearance of Jessica. Craig Harpster testified that he had been the one to find the gas station empty and to call police. Susan Follette, who worked the early shift at the gas station, testified that she had been riding her motorcycle past the gas station the night that Jessica vanished and had seen a suspicious silver van parked beside it. She and her husband parked nearby and observed a man close, open, and then close again the rear hatch of the van and then drive off. Police officer Joel Huskema testified that he had found a blood spot, batteries, and a cover to a battery compartment behind the gas station. The battery cover had been manufactured by Carl Walther, a gunmaker. Police officer Christopher Hare told the jury that following the disappearance, a tip had led them to Jeffrey. The tip had come from an employee at the Starbucks located around the corner from the gas station. The employee said that there was a frequent customer who drove a silver van and acted very odd. That customer was Jeffrey. When they interviewed him, he claimed that he was at home at the time that Jessica was being abducted. However, his phone records indicated otherwise. The teenage girl who had been abducted by Jeffrey was also called as a prosecution witness. She took the jury through her terrifying ordeal.
Did you get in the car?
Yes.
And when you got in the car, what happened?
I don't really remember the conversation. I remember as we were turning onto Green Creek, I asked to use the phone. And wait, can I back that up?
Yes.
When I got in, he rolled up the window and locked the door. And I asked him to roll the window back down, and I didn't mean to be rude. And he rolled the window back down, or I don't remember, but he asked if I could use his phone, and he said no, and then just stared at me, and I asked to get out of the car, and for him to stop the car.
Let me stop you, I'm sorry, NGN, let me stop you right there.
You're okay.
Was there a reason why you couldn't use the phone?
Oh, it was dead.
Okay, so this male told you couldn't use the phone because it was dead.
Yes.
But didn't say any of that when you were standing outside of the vehicle.
Correct.
All right. Now, you made the turn back onto Green Creek.
Yes.
Was that the direction? Or let me ask you this. Did you tell this male where you wanted to go? And
no.
Okay. Was that the direction you wanted to go in?
No.
Okay. Now, you indicated that once he told you the phone was dead, what happened with the cell phone?
I don't remember.
Okay, fair enough. And you indicated, and I didn't mean to cut you off, but you
You're
indicated
fine.
That this male was staring at you.
Yes.
Did that describe how that made you feel?
Creeped out. I wanted to get out of the car.
All right. Did you, in fact, ask to get out of the car?
Yes.
And what happened?
He just kept going and stared at me, but he was slowing down.
Okay. Then what happened?
He reached under his seat and grabbed a gun.
Okay.
And pointed it at me, and I unlocked the door and jumped out.
All right. Now, this gun, could you describe it?
It was just like little handgun, and it had an orange tip on it.
All right. I'm sure you're not a gun expert, is that right?
Nope.
Okay. Did you know whether, if I asked you, well, I'm not going to ask you that question straight then. So, guns pointed at you.
Yes.
What's going through your mind?
To get away from him.
All right. Did the car ever stop?
No. After I jumped out, it stopped.
All right. Good answer to a bad question. When you asked the car to stop, did it ever stop?
No.
Did you say anything about stopping the car after the gun was pointed at you?
No.
What did you do?
Just jumped out.
All right. What happens to you?
I was running down the road and screaming for him, please not to kill me. And then after I was far from him, he told me it was just a joke and he was just kidding. And then I ran to a stranger's house.
Okay.
She also testified that she picked Jeffrey out of a lineup following his arrest. Michigan State Police Sergeant Thomas Flowers testified about the locked boxes found inside Jeffrey's van.
What are those photographs of, sir?
Those are the photographs of the contents of the lockbox.
And could you describe for the judge what was in that lockbox, please?
There is a semi-automatic pistol, a pair of black gloves, a set of handcuffs, a few different syringes, a vial of insulin, and a couple of, looks like, handcuff keys.
Okay. Is there any medication of some kind?
Through the picture, I can see the vial, but I can't see what it is, but I'm pretty sure it was labeled insulin.
Okay. In particular, and I'm sorry, it's kind of hard to see, but those blue pills.
Yes. I don't know what those blue pills were, but they obviously are in there also.
Okay. Now, this particular box, was it open or, what kind of box? How would you describe it?
It's a small metal lock box. It had a combination lock, and the corner of it was slightly ajar, so you could still see into it even though it was locked.
Okay. And do you recall, Sergeant Flowers, the caliber of this semi-automatic pistol?
It was a .22 caliber.
Okay.
Inside the van, they had also found handcuffs attached to a chain, rope, a ball gag, a steel pole with restraints, lubricating jelly, sex toys, as well as a list of names and addresses, and a photograph of a man with two nude women. There was also a drawing of a woman's body with what appeared to be injection points, labelled as fast, medium, and slow speed. He testified that in Jeffrey's grandfather's abandoned home, he had found four bottles of bleach in the basement, as well as seven containers of laundry detergent with bleach. Gerald McCarthy, an employee of the Michigan State Police's Computers Crime Unit, testified about the hard drives found in Jeffrey's home. He said that there were hundreds and hundreds of folders which contained thousands and thousands of what he described as the most horrifying and gruesome videos, depicting the abduction, rape, torture, and murder of women. He said that the women in the videos were violently raped and then murdered by being shot, stabbed, drowned, suffocated, burned, hanged, strangled, or beaten.
The one thing that I'm interested in, Mr. McCarthy, because I'm sure you know, where do folks find this stuff? I mean, what links do you have to go to actually find this and download it?
Well, you have to go to specific websites. There was a number of websites that through internet history records on the computer that I was able to determine that the user of this computer was going to download these type of videos.
Now, when you say computer, you're talking about the ASUS?
The ASUS computer,
okay,
yes.
Okay, so the ASUS tower, you were able to see some internet history of searches for this kind of stuff.
Yes, in addition, a lot of these videos have the actual website name embedded in the video. And this particular video titled The Jogger had the website heavy-r.com embedded in the video, which is an indication that that's where the video was downloaded from.
From the internet history that you saw for this type of stuff, what sort of websites or search engines are being used or generated? What did you find?
There was a number of them. One of them was called rapelover.com. Another one was called xxxrape.com. Another one that was heavily used was heavy/r.com, which is a website that I've seen before and have actually looked at, which is has hundreds and thousands of these type of murder videos, rape videos, killing videos.
He said that he had also found homemade videos of random women in parking lots and one of girls at a bus stop. He testified about the folder found, which was titled with Rebecca's initials, and testified about the photographs of Rebecca that were found inside the folder. All of the photographs had been saved from the internet. Charlene Bishop, Jeffrey's ex-wife, would also be called to testify during the trial.
Now, do you recall receiving a letter from him shortly after that?
Yes.
And what was the contents of the letter? What was it referencing?
It was referencing what what he had been doing the day Rebecca Blatch had been shot, and what I remembered or what he intended me to remember.
Okay.
I felt like he was planting memories.
And why do you say that?
Because it was on a Sunday, and I have a schedule on Sundays.
Okay.
At the time, Sunday school, 9:30 to 9:45 was when it started. Church at 11, lunch between 12 and 12:30 with family and friends from church, and then when I got home, a nap. And I napped until it was time for to get him ready for work.
Now, there was there any reference in that letter about clothing?
Yes, he said that he went to work with a dirty shirt.
And what can you tell me, what can you tell the jury about that?
That was not something he would have accepted.
Were you the person that normally did the laundry?
Yes, I did the laundry and it had to be done.
She said that shortly after Jeffrey was arrested, he had written a letter from Jill, in which he spoke about the events of the day that Rebecca was killed. She said, it felt like he was planting memories. She said that Rebecca had been killed on a Sunday, and their Sundays were very routine. She revealed that they had been together for 18 years, married for 13 years, but said that for the last 5 years of their marriage, they had essentially lived separate lives. She tried to mention that Jeffrey had verbally abused her, but the defense objected and the judge asked the jury to ignore her comments. She said she didn't know what Jeffrey was doing on the day that Rebecca was killed, but said that her day had revolved around the church. She said that Kevin would often come around to their house for poker games, but said that this stopped after Jessica vanished. Testimony would focus quite heavily on the evidence in the case. Lieutenant Jeff Crump, a Michigan State Police ballistics expert, testified that the bullets that killed Rebecca had come from the Walther P-22 gun that was found inside Jeffrey's van. David Hayhurst, an employee at the Michigan State Police Forensic Biology Unit, testified that only Jeffrey's DNA was found on the grip and the trigger of the gun. His DNA was also found on the muzzle and found inside the barrel of the gun. Rebecca's DNA was found on two items inside a locked box in Jeffrey's van, including a pair of gloves. There was also strong support that it was found on a vibrator, also found inside the locked box. However, this could have come from touch transfer. On the second week of the trial, it was the defense's turn to put forward their case. Jeffrey would testify on his own behalf. He told the jury that he did not steal his co-worker Michelle's gun, but said that she had sold it to him with the serial number scratched off. He spoke about the videos found on his computer as well as the sex toys found inside his van, and said that his sex life with his wife went downhill after an abortion, and they had tried new things such as toys and videos. He said, "That was my outlet. I don't know any way else to put it. It's kind of embarrassing." The defense questioned him about the folders on his computer, labeled VICS, JLH and RBS. He claimed that he had made the folders to put his phone records in, just in case he was ever brought in for questioning. The prosecutor questioned, "So in 2014, you were squirreling through a phone record for a murder you didn't commit?" Jeffrey replied, "Yes." He testified about the abduction of the teenager and said that she had gotten into the car herself.
"Now she gets in. Now she's sitting next to you. Do you observe anything about her?"
She's real jittery.
What was your initial impression?
I thought she was on drugs or something. She looked like she was on meth.
Okay. And so she's real jittery. She's sitting in the seat, correct?
Yeah.
Does she put her seatbelt on?
No.
Okay. Do the two of you have a conversation?
Not that I recall.
Okay. MJM jumps out of the vehicle, right?
Right.
The vehicle was still moving.
Yes.
Were you, and I think you testified you were slowing down at the time, but it was still moving, correct?
I was probably going about 15 miles an hour.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly. I didn't really look at it, so.
All right.
I just know I hit the brakes almost immediately.
When?
After she jumped out.
Okay. Were you surprised that she jumped out?
Yeah.
Had you threatened her?
No.
Had you pointed a gun at her?
No.
Toy gun?
No.
All right.
The defense would attempt to introduce reasonable doubt, and would try to point the finger at Kevin. They read aloud from an interview Kevin had with investigators in which he admitted that he touched the gun that he believed was used in the murder of Rebecca, and admitted that he had reset his mobile phone because it had porn on it as well as photographs from Rebecca, from her Facebook account. He said that he knew Rebecca through the soccer team both of their children played on. This interview also contained Kevin telling investigators that Jeffrey had told him that he killed Rebecca. He said that Jeffrey had told him he had used a lasso on Rebecca, intending for it to go around her neck. However, it slipped around her ankles and she started to run, so Jeffrey shot her. Kevin had also told investigators that Jeffrey had asked him to get rid of the gun and he was afraid that his DNA may have been on it. Jeffrey testified that his cousin had borrowed his Walther P2 two-handgun in May because he was thinking of buying one. He then returned it in mid-July, around a month after Rebecca was murdered. It was also revealed that Kevin had borrowed a pair of batting gloves, and these gloves would be found locked in a toolbox inside a Jeffrey's van. These gloves contained Kevin's DNA. The prosecution rebutted by acknowledging that Rebecca's DNA wasn't found on the gloves, so in short, the gloves were quite irrelevant to the case, as they clearly hadn't been used during the murder. Kevin's wife, Rhonda Blum, would also provide an alibi for Kevin, stating that he was at a soccer tournament on the day that Rebecca was killed. After all of the evidence was presented, Prosecutor Hilson turned to the jury and said, "I've never seen pure evil, but the defendant to me is pure evil. Not only does he have the willingness to lie, but he has no problem killing people." He reiterated the prosecution's belief that Jeffrey intended on kidnapping Rebecca that day, but she fled for her life, before he came up behind her and killed her. He went back to the teenage abduction victim of Jeffrey and said that she would have been victim number 3 if she did not escape. He reminded the jury that Rebecca was shot once from afar, and then the killer came closer and shot her again. "That's premeditated murder," he said. His closing testimony was followed by Defence Johnson, who asked the jury to take pause, telling them that convicting the wrong person would not be justice for Rebecca or her family. The jury only testified for 2 hours before they returned with a verdict.
Guilty. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, you've heard the verdict announced by the bailiff indicating that you find the defendant guilty of first-degree premeditated and first-degree felony murder and guilty of felony firearm.
They found Jeffrey Willis guilty of the murder of Rebecca Bletch. Following the verdict, Rebecca's sister said that the verdict was bittersweet. She said, "I don't want to see the end. I don't want her to be forgotten." 2 jurors would later say that it was all of the evidence as well as Jeffrey's contradictory statements, which led them to believe that he was guilty. A couple of days later, Kevin pleaded no contest to being an accessory after Jessica's murder. This wasn't an admission of guilt, but was being treated as one at sentencing. But first, it was time for Jeffrey to be sentenced. The sentencing phase was a couple of days before Christmas of 2017. Jeffrey would be sentenced to life in prison. Jeffrey would show his true colours when moments before Rebecca's family provided impact statements, he requested to leave the courtroom.
Yes, Your Honour. Your Honour, I guess we're here for a couple things, Judge. We're here for the motion and the sentence.
Oh, correct. You're right.
However, and I've just been informed it's a third man event that I have to bring the court's attention. Your Honor, it is the position of the defense that we are hereby requesting that my client be allowed to leave these proceedings at this juncture. He has informed me that that is his desire, and I would offer the court the opportunity to inquire of him if that's what he wishes to do. I don't know of any requirement that he actually be here. We will be obviously stipulating to proceed with sentencing and the motion thereafter. However, at this juncture, I'd ask the court to allow my client to be relieved for being present at this particular hearing.
Well, Judge, I mean, obviously, I guess I don't know of any. This is unprecedented for me. I've never had this motion ever been made before.
Why not required to be here?
And I don't disagree with that. It's unfortunate that he's choosing this cowardly way of doing it, but certainly he's been convicted. The family deserves the right to address the court, which they intend to do. And they also, in some respects, deserve the right to address the person convicted of killing their daughter and sister. But, you know, that being said, whatever the court decides. But certainly I think it's kind of, I'll leave it at that, Judge.
The judge granted Jeffrey's request. He blew a kiss to the courtroom before being led out. His actions led to some in attendance calling him a coward. It goes without saying that Jeffrey was a deplorable man, but he didn't even have the decency to sit through the victim impact statements. Rebecca's mother, Deborah, spoke to the courtroom.
So it's been very difficult to say everything I want to say, but this coward should have been here to listen to us. We deserve a right to tell him exactly how we feel, and for him to walk out on us was just horrible. He doesn't deserve anything. He should be in prison and not kept by himself in jail. And I just want to say I appreciate the jurors and everybody that backs us. I appreciate it all. And thank you to you. I can't go on.
Without Jeffrey present, they provided their victim impact statements and spoke of the loss they felt from Rebecca's murder. Her sister Jessica said that Rebecca was everything that a big sister should have been, and that she was an amazing mother. Her other sister Nicole called on Jeffrey to confess to what he had done with Jessica's body, stating, "They deserve a body to lay to rest. He claims that he's not a monster, but his actions speak louder than words." Rebecca's father, Nick Winberg, spoke with M Live outside of court, and said that as a Christian family, they were going to move forward and live good lives and conquer evil with good.
We have to move forward. The Bible says to keep conquering evil with good, and my family will. We are going to move forward and live good lives, and we're happy that this is finally happened, the sentencing for life in prison. It's rough, it's emotional, but we're happy and content. It's sad that Willis slipped out like he did.
It would later be revealed that while Jeffrey had been allowed to leave the courtroom, as he was transported to prison, sheriff's deputies played the victim impact statements on repeat. They had recorded them and had placed them on a CD. As he was driven 145 miles to prison, the victim impact statements emanated from the jail van speakers. In January of 2018, Kevin Blum was released from jail. He was required to wear an electronic GPS bracelet and was ordered to serve the maximum of 5 years on probation. Following Jeffrey's actions in court, a bill was introduced which would force defendants to hear victim impact statements. In March of that year, the Rebecca Bletch Law was passed and was signed into law in May. Shortly thereafter, Jeffrey stood trial for the murder of Jessica Haringa, and after deliberating for 1.5 hours, he was also found guilty of her murder and was handed down another life sentence. Jessica's body has never been found.
My daughter and this other party, they're innocent people. They can't speak for themselves. Who's going to speak for these people that are innocent like this? There's just too much going on in society today, especially evil against women.
It was the heroic actions of a teenage girl that would lead to the discovery of a sadistic serial killer. There are certain crimes out there that have ripple effects, but this was a case that had more of a tidal wave than a ripple effect. Swept up in that grim tidal wave were two innocent women and an innocent teenage girl. the murders of Rebecca Bletch and Jessica Haringa showed that a warped family loyalty can be stronger than the desire to do the right thing. If Kevin Blum had have spoken up, then maybe Jeffrey Willis would have been apprehended long before he got the opportunity to murder another woman and inflict a lifetime of trauma on a teenage girl. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Sandy and Alan. You can support Morbidology on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. There are no obligations, you can cancel anytime, and you can even sign up annually for 15% off. In return for your support, you get Morbidology merch, including t-shirts, stickers, pins, badges, and fridge magnets. You also get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes of some episodes, including case files I obtained via Freedom of Information. You can also request a case for me to cover on the podcast. As I've mentioned a whole bunch of times, and you're all probably annoyed by now, but I'd love for you guys to take part in my live streams on the Stereo app. They're all true crime related. We've done a true crime quiz and chatted about the true crimes that inspired the storylines in American Horror Story. It's totally free to download and it's an audio-based platform, meaning you don't have to go on camera to join in. Just click the link to Stereo in my show notes so that you don't miss the live streams. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo of the amazing new true crime podcast from the Podmini app. True love, truer crimes. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing day.
You're listening to Podmini.
We all know the typical fairy tale love story. Two people meet, fall in love, and live happily ever after. But what happens when that happily ever after includes cannibalism, sleeping in a coffin, or killing your own parents? In True Love, Truer Crimes, we'll dive into those stories, examining the relationships of the world's most notorious criminal couples, their lives before they met each other, their love story, their crimes, and how their grisly fairy tale ended. You'll hear all about people who truly would do anything for love. A husband and wife who killed people they thought were witches. A woman who fell in love with a con artist and kept his con going to find victims. A couple whose idea of a dinner date was cooking each other a rack of human ribs. All of the important questions will be answered, like how they met, who kissed who first, who found the first victim, and who testified against their lover in exchange for a shorter prison sentence.
You've been listening to a Podmini original production. Thank you. Podmini. Thanks for listening.